If you just have a meeting and say, okay, so we've all decided, then people play telephone. If you can't overcome your discomfort with writing, you can record and distribute regular voicemails or short videos. These broadcasts can be supplemented with smaller one-to-many events, such as Q&A sessions when the CEO visits a local office, or a breakfast with that month's newly hired employees. For example, Mark Pincus of Zynga holds Monday morning coffee talks with all new employees joining that week. Electronic communications are great for establishing regular contact, but face-to-face interaction is still important for establishing a deeper, more emotionally resonant relationship. Reed Hastings meets this need by not having an office at all and wandering the halls and conference rooms of Netflix. As your company grows and plays an increasingly important role in your industry, you will likely experience a need to make more of your organization's sensitive information secret. You probably won't share the bank balance with all employees or keep people up to speed on the twists and turns of the latest fundraising effort. More secretive cultures might make this move in the tribe or village stages, but as a company gets closer to being publicly traded, even the most open cultures have to make moves in this direction. Transition number 5. Inspiration to data. What is the role of data in scaling your company? In an interview with Reed, Jeff Bezos of Amazon discussed how he makes data a critical part of his management process. If this is a decision based on opinions, then my opinion wins, said Jeff. However, data beats opinion, so bring data. Jeff follows this policy faithfully. On one occasion, he argued that Amazon customers would never answer questions from potential customers about a product. Just too much friction, he thought. The product team didn't try to change Jeff's opinion with rhetoric and argument. Instead, they emailed product questions to 1,000 Amazon customers who had recently purchased a product and tracked the responses. The data their simple experiment produced changed Jeff's mind, and the customer questions and answers section that resulted has added billions of dollars in incremental sales by increasing conversion rates. Data is the lifeblood of decision-making for any company, but it is particularly fundamental if it informs the design of your product or if acquisition marketing is your key distribution strategy. For example, when he was at Twitter, my Greylock colleague Josh Ellman needed to figure out how to keep Twitter users actively using the service. By analyzing the data, he was able to determine that the core users, who were 90% likely to be active month after month, were using Twitter on at least 7 different days per month. Further analysis showed that what set these users apart from the less active users was that they followed over 30 other Twitter users. Once Ellman understood these figures, Twitter was able to encourage new users to follow more accounts, and within 60 days, Twitter was able to get its ratio of daily active users to monthly active users above its 50% target. Most companies start with relatively little in the way of analytics during the family and tribe stages. They might have performed an analysis to estimate market size, but they rarely have much data from actual customers. At this stage, you're introducing a new product, not fine-tuning an existing process. You don't need an analytics dashboard to know if people are using your product or not. And if customers aren't using your product, a dashboard isn't going to tell you how to change course. In other words, if you don't have customers to listen to, the best you can do is listen to your gut. But as Harvard Business School's Ranjay Gulati and Alicia DeSantola noted in Startups That Last, this approach doesn't scale. Improvisation is integral to young ventures. It's how they make discoveries. However, as firms grow, they need a framework of plans and goals to guide them. That way, they can keep trying new things and reacting to dynamic markets, but with an eye toward larger objectives and sustaining the business. Otherwise, improvisation essentially amounts to aimless riffing. You're already dealing with your fair share of unknowns as your company grows at a breakneck pace, so it makes sense to seek certainty wherever you can. To make the transition from inspiration or improvisation to data more easily, it helps to start with the basics. Track a few key stats, such as the number of users, registered users, application downloads, retail buyers, etc., churn, and raw engagement. When Selena Tobacowala joined SurveyMonkey in 2009, she had to build up the company's data infrastructure quickly. There were no analytics before 2009, Selena told our blitzscaling class at Stanford. There was a daily cash report, and that was it. I strongly believe that as a whole company, you can't get behind more than 3 to 5 metrics. The key metrics we picked were free users that become paid users, and then user engagement metrics, number of surveys, and return rate. Sometimes, even a single metric can tell you a lot. At YouTube, Shishir Mehrotra decided that their single clarifying metric would be watch time. "Our goal was to get to 1 billion hours per day of watch time," he said. "At the time, we were doing 100 million hours per day. Facebook had about double that. Television as a whole was 5.5 billion hours per day." Picking a single clarifying metric is very hard, but it clarifies decision-making and what constitutes success. Whatever metrics you select, that information must be easy to access and provide clear context. Particularly when your company is still small and lean, with limited manpower, it pays to invest in the infrastructure necessary to support fast, data-driven decision-making. A text-based log file might technically provide all the data you need, but anyone who has to manually process that data into a user-friendly graph each time will rapidly stop using that data to drive decisions. What matters isn't what you collect, but what you convey to decision-makers. The key stats will evolve as your company grows. You can't simply set it and forget it when it comes to data. The critical metrics for predicting the long-term viability of your business may be very different as you achieve scale, particularly if the environment is changing rapidly. For that matter, your definition of long-term will change a great deal. In the family stage, next month often counts as long-term, whereas a nation-stage company might have multi-year plans. At LinkedIn, we began with a laser focus on the number of user registrations as our key stat, but the long-term engagement of our users and a number of other stats are more important today. This doesn't mean that you should throw out all your old metrics. There can be a lot of value to continuity. For example, Mariam Nafisi of Minted told me, "The key is to create consistent questions from the beginning and not to change them over time, because that's the only way to compare metrics over time." We've been using Net Promoter Score, a customer loyalty metric that measures how likely customers would be to recommend a product or service to others, from the beginning. Watch out for what Eric Reese dubbed vanity metrics, numbers that present a rosy picture of the business but don't actually reflect its key drivers of growth. Note that one company's vanity metric might be another's key driver. For example, page views are a vanity metric for most startups, but the key driver for a media company. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, Ev Williams, founder of Blogger, Twitter, and Medium, reported that in the early days of Twitter, his team got caught up in a particularly harmful vanity metric. Twitter was being praised in the press for encouraging developers to build on top of its API, and Ev's team celebrated the rapid rise in the volume of API calls Twitter was handling each day. Unfortunately, they discovered that API call volume didn't actually correlate with business success. In fact, the opposite was true. The large number of API calls were overwhelming Twitter's infrastructure and causing scalability and performance issues. "We discovered that a lot of the developers who built on top of our API were very inefficient," he recalled. "There was one Mexican radio station that had a particularly bad JavaScript on their webpage. Just that one webpage was bringing us down." Twitter had to tighten its API access rules to reduce the call volume. Whatever metrics you choose, when the organization is still small, the data can generally spread via osmosis between individual employees, supplemented by a regular review during weekly company meetings. You don't need fancy business intelligence, BI, tools, or a dedicated team. Once your organization reaches the village stage, however, osmosis won't work. Your people are working on multiple threads, and the organization, which has exceeded Dunbar's number, is now too big for everyone to know one another. Using a common dashboard will allow you not only to see how the threads interlock, but also to coordinate the work of different groups. Through the dashboard, each group can tell the others, "This is what we're working on, this is how we're doing it, and this is how we're working together with the rest of you." Almost all quality village-sized businesses will use a dashboard to assess the daily health of their companies. Your organization's dashboard will tell you what you want to track and ensure that you're keenly aware of sudden changes so that you can quickly investigate any surprises and assign actions to the responsible person or group. At the city and nation stages, you'll almost certainly need a dedicated BI team to ensure that the necessary data is getting to the people who need to support and carry out key decisions. The stakes are so high and the cost of bad decisions so great that the expense of a dedicated team is small in comparison. Mark Pincus invested heavily in his BI team at Zynga, which allowed the company to track every click in their games rather than rely on Google Analytics like most of his competitors. "People would say, 'Zynga has 50 people working on analytics. This other company only has 10,' Mark recalled during an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast. "Zynga must be dumb. Actually, Collecting that data lets us make and evaluate our bets faster. In addition to simply supplying data and insights to existing business units, many of the top-performing companies create a dedicated growth team, which combines marketing, product, and engineering to drive and coordinate the response to these insights. Most companies, even in the highly competitive world of the consumer internet, still think it's sufficient to conduct a lot of A/B tests and iterate accordingly. This is an effective tactic, but poor strategy since local optimizations do not necessarily lead to a globally optimal result. A dedicated growth team can look at the big picture and see how product and marketing decisions interact to produce or not produce the desired results. According to Greylock's Josh Ullman, the best growth teams identify the core insights that get users from curious to activated habitual users and build every feature and program in the product, including the non-software features that are part of the whole product, to get users through this hurdle faster. A growth team also helps by making growth a number one priority rather than a second or third class citizen. Ullman likes to compare a typical marketing team to a Dickensian orphan, pleading with the product and engineering teams for resources. "Please, sir, may I have another landing page?" Any product changes or engineering infrastructure needed to drive growth, no matter how potentially valuable, typically end up taking a backseat to the product or engineering team's own roadmaps. In contrast, a growth team's engineers can move far faster because building a scalable and extensible testing infrastructure is a core part of their jobs. One of the challenges you face as you build up your data capabilities is that your strategy can disappear behind the numbers. The numbers might not measure the real health of the business or reveal the real major threats you face. For example, if LinkedIn were to email all of its members every week to remind them to update their LinkedIn profiles, the initiative would result in a short-term boost to profile edits. It would also be a horrible strategy because it would annoy the users and degrade the user experience. Jonathan Rosenberg of Google has told the story of how blindly managing to the numbers led Excite at Home astray. Excite at Home measured the click-throughs on every element of its homepage. If an element didn't look like it would hit its click-through target, Excite at Home would make the element more visually prominent. In other words, in attempting to hit its numbers, the homepage team was emphasizing the least compelling elements and de-emphasizing the most compelling ones. This is why you may need to blend quantitative and qualitative analysis. Our friend John Lilly likes to distinguish between genius-driven design, e.g. Apple, and data-driven design, e.g. Google. Both approaches have their strengths and weaknesses. Data-driven design is great at optimizing products with incremental changes, but it could steer you to the top of a local hill rather than the highest peak. Genius-driven design may be the only way to build a revolutionary product, but it usually needs to be supplemented with data-driven refinement. Transition number 6. Single focus to multi-threading. As the company grows, the product focus will also undergo a major change, from a single threading to a multi-threading approach. What we mean by this is that startups in the early stages of blitzscaling are generally single product companies that focus on doing one thing extremely well. But to keep the company growing in the later stages, scale-ups need to manage multiple product lines or even business units. We don't know of a single startup that succeeded without starting out as single-threaded. That focus is the key to beating larger competitors in the early stages of a company's existence. For years, Drew Houston of Dropbox was told that Google would kill his company because of its secret Project Platypus, which eventually launched as Google Drive. Houston found these proclamations more annoying than frightening because he knew the power of singular focus. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, he explained, "For a company like Google that's doing 100 different things, there's a very long breadline to get the next good engineer. And if you're project number 35, which is about where Google Drive was on their list, it's going to take a long time before that team gets fed with any amazing people. When you consider the 11 players you put on the field versus your counterpart at a big company, you can actually have a massive talent advantage. Not because Google doesn't have great engineers. They probably have better engineers than you. But the leader of the project is a mid-level product manager for whom it's just the next rung on the ladder. As a founder, you're just so much more committed, and your team is so much more committed." Today, years after the launch of Google Drive, Dropbox continues to grow in terms of both users and paying customers. So much for the Dropbox killer. Even companies that pivot several times, as PayPal did in its first year, need to stay focused, especially as they shift their attention and effort from one initiative to another. My Greylock colleague Joseph Ancinelli, the co-founder and CEO of the customer service software startup Gladly, tells entrepreneurs, "Don't try a second channel until you have your main flywheel working. Most successful companies dominate one channel." The shift to multi-threading usually occurs during the city stage of blitzscaling. Once the company has more than 1,000 employees, the organization is large enough to support the creation of multiple divisions or business units. While moving to a decentralized organization makes it harder to coordinate the different divisions or business units, the key motivation for the change is how it allows each group to focus on its specific thread. Your teams need the ability and the manpower to relentlessly pursue a specific objective. Asking a team to split its time between two different business lines is likely to result in the failure of both. This is especially true when the main thread is a business line that has matured. In their Harvard Business Review article, The Ambidextrous Organization, Charles A. O'Reilly III and Michael L. Tushman draw the distinction between exploiting and exploring. Mature business lines focus on incremental innovations that help them exploit a well-known market, whereas new threads focus on more radical innovations and exploring a new market opportunity. They examined 35 attempts to spin up new threads across 9 different industries. What they found was that these efforts were most likely to be successful in ambidextrous organizations, where the new threads were organized as structurally independent units but integrated into the existing management structure. In other words, the leaders of the new threads not only have the freedom to innovate, but also the ability to coordinate with senior leadership to leverage existing resources and expertise from more mature threads. Multi-threading your organization allows you to tackle problems that might not be vulnerable to a single-threaded approach. At LinkedIn, for example, we knew that we needed to address the issue of user engagement. LinkedIn is enormously valuable as a database of resumes, but it is even more valuable as the leading community for professionals. The challenge was figuring out how to develop a daily use case that helped LinkedIn users with their professional lives and encourage them to use the service continuously rather than just when they were looking to switch jobs or hire a new employee. We tried a number of single-threaded efforts to meet the challenge. We rolled out features, one after another, such as a recommendation engine for people that our users should meet and a professional Q&A service. None of them worked well enough to solve the problem. We concluded that the problem might require a Swiss Army knife approach with multiple use cases for multiple groups of users. After all, some people might want a newsfeed, some might want to track their career progress, and some might be keen on continuing education. Fortunately, LinkedIn had grown to the point where the organization could support multiple threads. We reorganized the product team so that each director of product could focus on a different approach to address engagement. Even though none of those efforts alone proved a silver bullet, the overall combination of them significantly improved user engagement. Multi-threading comes with a definite cost. Some people are eager to jump to multi-threading as quickly as possible because they think it increases their competitive bandwidth. In reality, you should be thoughtful and careful about making this decision. Companies like Google grant a great deal of freedom to individual units, and as a result, many different products and services do not fit together seamlessly. Many of Google's services are strong enough to succeed on their own, but this means that they are succeeding in spite of, rather than because of, multi-threading. In contrast, Apple's highly centralized approach allows it to produce highly integrated and polished products, but as a result, it restricts itself to a much smaller product line. Of course, this is intentional. Steve Jobs always wanted to run as close to single-threaded as possible to maintain Apple's unity of purpose. One of the first things Steve did when he returned to Apple as CEO in 1997 was to reduce the company's product line from dozens to a simple 2x2 matrix: consumer desktop, pro desktop, consumer laptop, and pro laptop. "Deciding what not to do is as important as deciding what to do," he told his biographer Walter Isaacson. Another famous Steve story involves an Apple strategy offsite where Apple's top 100 people worked for a day to reduce Apple strategy to 10 key priorities, at which point Steve crossed off the bottom 7 items and said, "We can only do 3. Generally, you should start adding threads when it's strategically necessary and with a realistic assessment of the negative impact that multi-threading will have on organizational focus, resource efficiency, and so on. At LinkedIn, we made an explicit strategy decision to multi-thread our revenue model, even though the conventional wisdom in Silicon Valley is to stick to a single revenue model. We were criticized for having a mishmash of revenue streams such as pro subscriptions, job listing fees, and enterprise licensing for our recruiter product. It's true that there was a cost to this strategy in terms of focus, but I believe that we didn't have enough information to pick a single revenue stream and have it be sufficient to build our intended scale of business. Multi-threading to support multiple revenue lines both mitigated strategic risk and helped us get to scale. One important technique for making this decision is to consider both the magnitude of the opportunity as well as its potential for gain. If you have a billion-dollar opportunity, it makes sense to invest more resources and eke out a 5% gain, $50 million, than to grow a nascent million-dollar opportunity by a factor of 1,000%, $10 million. This is why it's generally better to have your 10 best people working on a single important project rather than splitting them to attack two different opportunities. For example, AdWords is such an enormous revenue driver for Google that even tiny percentage increases make a huge difference to the bottom line. Conversely, when the potential for gain associated with your core opportunity declines, multi-threading is often the answer to attack better growth opportunities. The company eBay can be thought of as a collection of markets. While eBay might have started with collectibles, multi-threading to expand into different markets like cars and apparel was essential to reaching its current scale. More recently, Tencent's creation of WeChat is an example of aggressive multi-threading. Assuming that you make the decision to multi-thread your organization, the optimal management approach is to think of each thread as a different company. For each thread, you'll need to identify a leadership team, co-founders, and create an incentive structure that allows it to operate with a great deal of independence and reap the benefits of success without making your current manager so envious that it tears the organization apart. This is always challenging. Further complicating matters, people with the entrepreneurial drive required to make multi-threading successful usually want to start their own companies or apply their skills to the company's main thread. One thing that can keep these employees motivated is making the various threads discrete projects, the equivalent of apps running on the main thread's platform. This makes it easy to answer the question, why shouldn't I just start my own company? By pointing out the benefits of building on the platform. This structure also makes it easier to manage multiple threads, since the individual threads are less likely to come into conflict. The incentives of multi-threading have to reflect the success of each thread, while still keeping the leadership of each thread invested in the success of all the rest. Without this balance, the different threads might engage in internecine warfare over resources, and the individual leadership teams might prioritize the success of a secondary thread over the health of the entire company. You want to give leadership a reason to make each thread work, but not at the expense of the others. In other words, you want the owners of each of the threads thinking like an owner of the overall company. Poorly designed incentives can make it nearly impossible to shut down a thread, even if its performance is poor, since its leadership might fight tooth and nail to stay open. You might be tempted to simply treat each thread like a separate company within an overall holding company. After all, doesn't that work for Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway? The difference is that Berkshire Hathaway's companies are separate, non-competitive, cash-generating businesses that have a history of independent operations and complete management teams. In contrast, when a blitzscaling company starts setting up multiple threads, they are still attached, might be competitive, are likely consuming the same pool of cash, and have no history of independent operations. One of the people I've personally seen handle these issues with exceptional skill is Deep Nishar, LinkedIn's former head of product, and now at SoftBank. Deep set up LinkedIn's different product threads and expertly managed the product leaders to create a broader sense of ownership via a web of alignment. Each product leader was the owner of a primary thread, but was also partially accountable and compensated for his or her work in supporting a fellow product leader as a secondary thread. This produced an additional layer of alignment, which reinforced the alignment of all being part of the LinkedIn holding company. Transition number 7, pirate to navy. This key transition is the shift from playing offense to playing offense and defense at the same time. More poetically, it's the shift from being a pirate to being part of the navy. It requires an evolution in strategy as well as an evolution in company culture. For decades, technology entrepreneurs have had an affinity for pirates. As with many of the classic tropes of the startup world, the link between startups and pirates was codified by the late Steve Jobs. Andy Hertzfeld, a legendary serial entrepreneur who worked at Apple and helped design the original Macintosh, related the story on his website, folklore.org. When Jobs gathered together the Macintosh team for an offsite shortly after the release of the Lisa, he famously kicked off the proceedings by laying out three sayings from Chairman Jobs as guiding principles for the project. 1. Real artists ship. 2. It's better to be a pirate than to join the Navy. 3. Mac in a book by 1986. Inspired by Steve's words, the Macintosh team created a homemade pirate flag, complete with the classic skull and crossbones, with a rainbow-colored Apple logo decal as an eye patch. The image of a pirate continued to be so widely associated with startups that when the cable network TNT released a movie in 1999 about the heated rivalry between Steve Jobs and Apple and Bill Gates and Microsoft, it was titled Pirates of Silicon Valley. The reality is that many startups are like pirates. They lack formal processes and are willing to question and even break rules. This flexibility is critical in the early stages of building a great company. Pirates don't convene a committee meeting to decide what to do when an enemy ship is approaching. They act quickly and decisively and are willing to take risks because they know that the default outcome is death. Early stage startups are also on the full offensive, waging guerrilla warfare on bigger, established competitors. They are used to striking quickly, using surprise as a weapon, and taking on risks that established companies can't or won't. During the early stages of blitzscaling, family and tribe, it's easier to take risks because you don't have much to lose. As Chris Christopherson wrote, and Janis Joplin, among others, saying, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." But if you succeed as a pirate, you'll eventually win enough wealth and territory to blitzscale to the village, city, and nation stages. At that point, even the most inveterate pirates will have to trade in their Jolly Roger for the flag of a legitimate, disciplined navy. If they don't, their organizations will devolve into chaos. Eventually, Captain Jack Sparrow has to grow up and start acting more like the sober and responsible Captain Picard. This transition can be challenging. Founders and early employees often resist changing their approach. After all, didn't it bring about their initial success? Plus, entrepreneurs tend to have a rebellious streak. Natural-born rule followers don't always fare so well in a chaotic, move-fast-and-break-things startup environment. But failing to make the transition from pirate to navy can lead to disaster. A note on ethical piracy. Before we go further, we need to spend at least a little time on dispelling some of the connotations of the word pirate. In print and on screen, pirates are portrayed in one of two ways. 1. Lovable rogues, and 2. Sociopathic criminals. The key differentiating characteristic of the lovable rogue, besides appearing more prominently on the movie poster, is that while she or he may question and break the laws of polite society, a lovable rogue adheres to a personal code of ethics and tries not to harm others. The lovable rogue is willing to break the rules, but remains moral. He or she is an ethical or good pirate. In contrast, the sociopathic criminal, as the name suggests, behaves in a purely selfish manner, breaking rules and thoughtlessly harming others in order to bring material benefits. While startups and their founders may benefit from behaving like ethical pirates, they should never behave like sociopathic criminals. Besides the fact that such an approach is morally wrong, as a practical matter, you simply can't build a world-changing company as an outlaw, and it is difficult to make the shift from deviant to mainstream society. And this is particularly true in a world where social media is quick to shine a spotlight on unethical practices that can tarnish a company's reputation forever. Go afoul of the law, and your customers will neither forgive nor forget. One of the key ways to assess whether you're being an ethical pirate or a sociopath is to ask, am I trying to change the rules for everyone, or just trying to get away with a personal exemption? At PayPal, we broke the rules, but we did so because we were working toward a better set of rules for everyone. We felt that our actions were ethical because while we could technically have been in violation of the letter of certain banking regulations, we consistently argued that we weren't a bank, but not everyone agreed, we believed that in the long run, we would be in compliance once we convinced the world to change the rules, and that the world would be better off as a result. History demonstrates that we were right. The various parties that were upset by our so-called pirate mentality, eBay, banks, regulators, all see the value of PayPal today. By changing the rules for everyone, we help pave the way for other payment companies like Square and Stripe, which have improved the world of mobile payment even further. Rules are not holy scripture. They exist to make the world a better place, and thus, if you can improve the rules, you should. On the other hand, rules usually exist for a reason. You need to have some humility when breaking rules and recognize that you might not understand all the consequences. It's not always cheating to break the rules, but it is always a high beta activity, hence the need for caution and compassion. A present-day example of a field where there are both ethical and unethical pirates is the rapid development of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and initial coin offerings, ICOs, as a financing tool. The startups that are creating currencies and holding ICOs are operating in a legal gray area and likely breaking rules. Some of these startups are ethical pirates who are working to change the rules for everyone. Others are sociopathic criminals who are simply trying to collect as much money as possible before the window closes, and devil take the hindmost. Both types might make money in the short term if the market is hot enough, but only the ethical pirates will be able to build lasting businesses, and only the ethical pirates will have a positive impact on the world. Joining the Navy. When your company reaches the village stage, it's time to start thinking less like a pirate and more like a navy. What does that mean? Well, you need to start following the rules, and you might want to consider playing defense. Until now, your sole focus has been offense. If you don't have customers, why do you need to worry about retaining them? Now you should ask, how can we lock out the competition? More blitzscaling is often the answer. Being the first scaler helps you acquire customers, lock in investors, and attract the best talent. I like to generate fresh, innovative ways to play defense by asking my team, if we were trying to compete with ourselves, what would we do? What if we were a startup? Google, Facebook, Microsoft. You can also seek outside perspectives, either by asking an independent board member or by leveraging network intelligence. During the city stage, defense often becomes the primary focus. Establishing a new competitive edge tends to be very difficult. You should focus on strengthening your existing market position instead. There are several best practices for doing so. First, try to establish a standard. One of the classic Silicon Valley plays is to move from an app to a platform so that you can attract people to build on and to your platform, thereby leveraging the network effect of compatibility. Salesforce.com's Force.com ecosystem is a great example of this. By offering the ability to build third-party applications on top of the Salesforce platform, Salesforce benefits from a force multiplier. There are over 2,800 apps on the Salesforce App Exchange, and an International Data Corporation, IDC, study showed that the Salesforce ecosystem generates 2.8 times the revenue of Salesforce.com itself. This means that while Salesforce.com has revenues of only $8.4 billion, its platform gives it the economic impact of a $32 billion company. Second, offer a more complete solution and try to outflank the competition. I like to say, both players are holding glasses of water and are trying to tip over the other person's glass. In other words, if your competitor suddenly started offering its core product for free, could you still make money on your core product? Interestingly, this focus on defense at the city stage of blitzscaling is different in China than in Silicon Valley. In China, companies will put teams on anything that has traction. In Silicon Valley, talent is so precious and there are so many other offensive plays that companies often can't afford to rely on a fast follower strategy. This means that in a very real sense, China is even more competitive than Silicon Valley, though I expect that over time, China will evolve to become more like Silicon Valley in this respect. At the nation stage, the transformation from pirate to navy is complete. If it's not, either you don't have a nation or you have failed to make the shift and your nation is in chaos. Witness Uber in 2017. In this phase, acquisitions typically become important, if not essential, to defensive strategy. You can acquire an innovative technology and team and then feed them with massive resources as they scale. This is how Google blitzscaled Android. Google acquired Android in 2005 when it was still just a small 22-month-old startup that was working on a new operating system for mobile phones. Google let Android founder Andy Rubin hire additional engineers to complete the product while using its market power and reputation to establish the Open Handset Alliance, a consortium to promote Android that included hardware makers Samsung, HTC, and Motorola, carriers Sprint and T-Mobile, and chipmakers Qualcomm and Texas Instruments. With this backing, Android grew quickly after its launch in the fall of 2008. Android exceeded the iPhone in number of phones shipped in 2010, and at over 1 billion phones per year, today makes up nearly 80% of global smartphone unit shipments. Acquisitions are the biggest offensive and defensive plays in your nation playbook. Think about how certain key acquisitions won a major market for their acquirers. The YouTube, Instagram, and WhatsApp acquisitions were both defensive and offensive. Acquiring YouTube allowed Google to recover from its failed Google Video initiative, but it also kept YouTube out of the hands of competitors like Microsoft. The Instagram and WhatsApp acquisitions helped Facebook defend against mobile incursions, but they also made Facebook the leader in mobile. Financial strategy can also become competitive strategy. For example, Apple's cash hoard allows it to move quickly and pay cash for any acquisition, two key advantages during a competitive bidding process. Finally, you may order your naval task forces to launch diversionary attacks that yield little tactical advantage, but that help the overall strategic situation. For example, Microsoft needs to field a search engine to compete with Google, even though it is unlikely to capture much market share, because Google is fielding productivity apps against Microsoft. At this phase, you should try to make your opponents defend every bit of their territories, because if you succeed, they will be stretched too thin to ward off the attacks you actually consider important. Just remember to save a few ships to fend off attacks from those pesky pirates. From Captain to Admiral. At the time of the writing of this book, the ride-sharing company Uber was Silicon Valley's most valuable startup and second globally to its frenemy, China's Didi Chuxing, despite having spent most of 2017 in the news for a number of serious problems and scandals. Some of these issues were due to clearly unethical behavior, including internal problems, such as the sexual harassment reported by former Uber engineer Susan Fowler, and various external attempts to subvert free competition, regulation, and the press, such as creating fake accounts to poach drivers from its rival Lyft, as reported by The Verge, developing software, Grayball, to prevent law enforcement and regulators from accessing the service, and then COO Emil Michael suggesting that the company spend money to hire opposition researchers to intimidate journalists. This kind of behavior is unacceptable, regardless of the size or stage of the company undertaking it, and has rightfully been widely condemned. Yet even if Uber had never engaged in the unethical behaviors outlined above, the company would still have faced real issues because of its reluctance to abandon its pirate-like strategies, many of them benign in its earlier days, despite its much greater size and scope. When Uber's board picked Dara Khosrowshahi as the company's new CEO in September 2017, it certainly helped that Dara had a well-deserved reputation for running a no-drama operation, a classic naval officer, in other words. But just as important was his experience in successfully growing Expedia into a profitable $20 billion, 20,000-employee giant that has won praise as one of the best-managed companies in its industry and a great place for work-life balance. While Dara will be dealing with many flashy, well-publicized issues at Uber, his biggest challenge and greatest opportunity will be steering Uber through the difficult but critical transition from pirate to Navy. To create a friendlier culture and halt the mass defection of top talent, win back the loyalty of drivers and riders, and put an end to the legal battles that have plagued the company, Uber's new chief executive will need to start behaving more like an admiral and less like a pirate captain. All startups recognize that there is a value to being small. Innovation, nimbleness, focus, outcome versus process. All successful entrepreneurs have the desire to stay small in this way. But the most successful scale-ups are those who have managed to keep the positives of staying small while reaping the benefits of being big. Dara was trying to strike this balance when he reset Uber's cultural norms in November of 2017. He announced the changes in a post on LinkedIn. As we move from an era of growth at all costs to one of responsible growth, our culture needs to evolve. Rather than ditching everything, I'm focused on preserving what works and quickly changing what doesn't. This is the approach we've taken with our new cultural values, which we announced to employees today. Our values define who we are and how we work, but I have heard from many employees that some of them simply didn't represent the kind of company we want to be. A firm believer that culture must be written from the bottom up, Dara didn't come up with a new set of values alone, behind the closed door of a conference room. Instead, he asked employees to submit ideas for how to improve Uber's culture. Over 1,200 people sent in submissions that were voted on more than 22 times. The new cultural norms that Dara unveiled reflect his different approach even in the simple nature of their language. Instead of highlighting lone wolf mottos like always be hustlin', the new culture emphasizes the group by starting each norm with the word we. We celebrate differences. We do the right thing. We act like owners. We make big, bold bets. Dara deserves credit for working hard to add Navy values, such as responsibility and doing the right thing, to Uber's ethical pirate values of boldness and aggression. But cultural change, while necessary, is not sufficient to turn a pirate gang into a real Navy. When the CEO of a large organization like Uber makes the transition from captain of a single pirate ship to an admiral running a fleet with naval-like discipline, there are well-established techniques and approaches that can help make this transition smoother and more effective. For example, if you're building a global business, there are three key elements you need to put in place. 1. A set of managers who are responsible for and have strong executive control over their individual markets globally. 2. An understanding of how those markets differ, which leads to a variety of plans for how to grow in each of those markets. 3. A unified executive team to coordinate global operations, including the activity of the individual managers leading operations in each country. The first two elements involve a decentralized command structure that allows the individual captains of the ships in the fleet to operate with entrepreneurial vigor. The third involves a centralized staff that can help the admiral coordinate the actions of the fleet for maximum impact. Uber actually did a good job with the first two elements. Uber's general managers are like individual ship captains, and their ability to act independently helped Uber develop innovations like surge pricing, which was an independent experiment conducted in the Boston market. Where Uber failed was its inability to commit to the third element, a unified executive team. When you have strong individual captains and an admiral who can't or won't build a staff to help him or her actually manage the fleet, you end up with a pirate mob. The failure to build a unified executive team is sadly common. Some entrepreneurs find it difficult to accept the increased structure and decreased freedom of a formal staff. Many of these people started companies precisely because they disliked the feeling of working in a large organization. In his book on Uber, Wild Ride, the journalist Adam Leshinsky describes how Uber's Travis Kalanick viewed his role at the helm of his giant company. "The way I do it, it doesn't feel big," Kalanick says, falling back on a favorite trope, that he approaches his day as a series of problems to be solved. "I would say you constantly want to make your company feel small," he says. "You need to create mechanisms and cultural values so that you feel as small as possible. That's how you stay innovative and fast. But how you do that at different sizes is different. Like when you're super small, you go fast by just tribal knowledge. But if you did tribal knowledge when you're super big, it would be chaotic and you'd actually go really slow. So you have to constantly find that line between order and chaos." Kalanick's words reveal a pirate's discomfort with running a large organization. He obviously thinks of himself as troubleshooter-in-chief as much as a CEO, Leshinsky writes. But while acting as a troubleshooter-in-chief might be a good fit for his personality, at the city or nation stage, getting too involved in the details of individual problems is probably a poor use of a CEO's time. Kalanick, in other words, was doing what felt good to him rather than what the organization needed. The purpose of hiring a management team is to solve the organization's problems in a more scalable way. The CEO should be the hub, and the executive team the spokes that connect the CEO to the frontline managers and employees operating where the rubber hits the road. Kalanick was trying to be the hub and the spokes, rather than helping the organization build the ability to get things done without his personal oversight. Another symptom of this dysfunction was Kalanick's habit of canceling his executive staff meetings. Without spending time together, it is difficult for a management team to build a group culture or to coordinate the many initiatives of the organization. A strong executive team meets on a regular basis and focuses on the most important initiatives and issues, including active planning for the future. According to a 2018 Forbes article, inside Uber's effort to fix its culture through a Harvard-inspired university, Uber's SVP of Leadership and Strategy, Francis Fry, described the management team's lack of cohesion as one of the largest problems facing the company. The article reports that Uber's senior executives weren't working as a team and only had one-on-one relationships with Kalanick, who oversaw them all. Kalanick is absolutely correct when he argues that staying small helps organizations stay innovative and fast, but staying small isn't always a possibility. It is better to build an organizational structure that you can iterate multiple times rather than to avoid scaling the organization as long as possible and make the shift in a single giant leap someday. In other words, you have to build management strategies that scale. Even someone as smart as Larry Page learned this during the early days of Google. He tried to run Google's engineering department without management by having all 400 employees report directly to then-VP of engineering Wayne Rosing. The failure of this experiment convinced him to allow then-CEO Eric Schmidt to build a real organizational structure at Google. Any given management structure is likely to be temporary. You can't run a village the same way you run a tribe, and you can't run a city the same way you run a village. But without structure, you won't make it to the next stage of growth. It appears that Kalanick's discomfort with Uber feeling big led to a dysfunctional organizational structure in which he clung to his previous ways. In the absence of a cohesive management team, Uber seemed to operate on a model that Susan Fowler described in her personal blog as a Game of Thrones political war with managers fighting for advancement. The ramifications of these political games were significant. Projects were abandoned left and right. OKRs were changed multiple times each quarter. Nobody knew what our organizational priorities would be one day to the next, and very little ever got done. We all lived under fear that our teams would be dissolved, there would be another reorg, and we'd have to start on yet another new project with an impossible deadline. It was an organization in complete, unrelenting chaos. When Uber tried to scale its management by hiring experienced executives like Jeff Jones from Target, they ended up resigning rather than changing the organization. During the first half of 2017 alone, Uber lost 8 VPs or department heads. In contrast, companies like Facebook and Amazon, and leaders like Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, found ways to successfully recruit leadership from the outside, blending them with existing team members to change and strengthen the organization. Facebook promoted insiders like Chief Product Officer Chris Cox, who joined Facebook as a software engineer in 2005 after dropping out of Stanford, but also brought in compatible outsiders like Sheryl Sandberg and Mike Schroepfer. Jeff Bezos' top lieutenants like Jeff Blackburn and Andy Jassy are Amazon lifers, but he also brought in key outsiders like Jeff Wilkie from Allied Signal and former chief information officer Rick Dalzell from Walmart. These outside hires can help even at massive scale. One of the benefits to Microsoft of buying LinkedIn has been adding Jeff Weiner and CTO Kevin Scott to Microsoft's executive team. As your fleet of pirate ships and followers grows, you need to intentionally shape them into a disciplined navy. A fleet of ships requires strong captains and a strong centralized staff that can coordinate and harness their entrepreneurial vigor. Every successful founder and every successful organization must go through these changes. But as Uber has discovered, blitzscaling makes these changes simultaneously harder because of the speed at which they must happen, and more important, because of the risk inherent in investing in speed over efficiency. Transition number 8, scaling yourself, founder to leader. All founders need some universal skills to succeed. They need the ability to take bold risks in pursuit of a vision that isn't self-evident to others. They need the ability to learn, since they're trying to do something brand new. And to play a long-term role at their startup turned scale-up, they need the ability to live with and resolve the inevitable paradoxes of being a founder. When I asked Dropbox founder Drew Houston to look back on his experience, he told me, "I think a lot of entrepreneurs start with a lot of insecurity about what they don't know. What you want is not to be paralyzed by it, but to harness it, to use that nervous energy to learn and make yourself better. You've got to keep your personal learning curve ahead of the company's growth curve." Maintaining a certain humility and a sense of perspective can help you navigate the changes in your role as you blitzscale your company. If you truly want to blitzscale, then speed has to take priority over everything, including your own ego. There are only three ways to scale yourself: delegation, amplification, and just plain making yourself better. Delegation. Can you find, hire, and manage good people, then transfer work over to them so you can tackle the challenges you're uniquely suited to tackle? Many founders are so talented that they have a hard time letting go of tasks once they start performing them. They often think things like, will someone else be able to do this as well as I can? The answer is almost certainly no, especially not at first, but they'll probably figure it out over time, just like you did. Startups get off the ground thanks to the individual talent and hard work of founders like Mark Zuckerberg and Brian Chesky, but they blitzscale into giant companies like Facebook and Airbnb because these founders learn how to delegate. One of the most important aspects of delegation, and often the most challenging for a founder, is to hire an executive and hand off functional leadership. For example, a lot of great founders are product people. Initial product market fit and success are achieved because of their product instincts. But as the company grows, these founders will almost always need to hire an executive to take over leadership of the product organization. It's too important to be a founder's part-time job. A key technique I use to overcome this challenge is to picture the hire as a specific living, breathing person rather than as a role written down on a piece of paper. When you try to picture an abstract head of product, for example, you might have a hard time visualizing this faceless entity doing a better job than you are. But when you picture a particular individual, say, Joe Zadeh of Airbnb, all of a sudden your mind shifts to thinking, wow, just imagine how awesome it would be to have someone like this running our product team. It might be difficult to hire this paragon. Executives who are that good are hard to pry loose from their current companies, but it doesn't hurt to try, and at least you'll have a great reference to which you can compare the people you actually consider hiring. Amplification. Rather than delegate work you're doing to others, can you hire people who amplify the work you do? The goal here isn't to free you up from your work so that you can do other things. It's to make the things you do much more impactful. This is actually one of the areas I've tried to develop and refine in my own life. Like many founders and executives, I have an amazing executive assistant, Saida Sapieva, to help me with scheduling and logistics. But I've discovered that you can take the concept of amplification much further. For example, I was one of the first startup leaders in Silicon Valley to borrow the chief of staff concept from the realm of politics and established corporations. Unlike a traditional assistant or even a technical assistant, your chief of staff should amplify your business impact. He or she should be a business person who can not only make certain decisions for you, but also triage the important decisions that you have to make yourself. A chief of staff can also make sure that all the people who want to meet or interact with you are briefed in advance so that your time together can be as efficient and effective as possible. My first chief of staff, Ben Kaznoka, was a successful author and entrepreneur before we began working together. My second, David Sanford, had worked with me at LinkedIn and had also been an entrepreneur and a restaurateur. It turned out that Ben and David were better at organizing my own life than I was. I've become significantly more productive since they started amplifying my efforts. To learn more about the role and value of a chief of staff, I recommend that you read Ben's essay on the topic, 10,000 Hours with Reid Hoffman, which you can find on his personal website, kaznoka.com. Once you begin to appreciate the power of amplification, you can find many ways to scale yourself. For example, one of the things you need to do is to process information about your company, your industry, and the world as a whole. I have a freelance researcher on my team, Brett Bolkowy, who helps me learn new things and answer key questions by finding the best information on any particular topic. Another key team member, Ian Alice, helps me with creative projects like the visual summaries I prepare for my books. The slideshows he created for my book, The Startup of You, have been viewed nearly 15 million times. Now that's amplification. Nor am I unique in this. For example, Mark Zuckerberg has a substantial team to help him manage his social media communications so that when he travels and meets people, he can maximize the impact of his interactions. Trusted employees, freelancers, or even a team of outside consultants can be your amplifiers. The official nature of the relationship is less important than having assistants that you can trust. making yourself better. Because your company grows and changes so quickly as you blitzscale, it's crucial for you to figure out how to make yourself better just as quickly so that you don't become the bottleneck that holds your company back. As our friend Jerry Chen likes to say, there are no job descriptions for founders. If the role doesn't change, there's something wrong. Since you're going to face new challenges during every stage of blitzscaling, you have to make yourself into a learning machine. My friend Elon Musk is a great example. He dropped out of Stanford's PhD program in applied physics because he thought he could learn more on his own. He started SpaceX and Tesla by learning literal rocket science and car making. So how do you accelerate your learning curve so that you can learn more faster? The key is to stand, as Isaac Newton wrote, on the shoulders of giants. This means talking with other smart people, often, so that you can learn from their successes and failures. It's usually easier and less painful to learn from another's mistakes than from your own. When I need to learn about a new subject, I'll definitely devour some books on the topic, but I almost always supplement this reading by seeking out dialogue with leading experts in the field. Brian Chesky at Airbnb, another amazing learning machine, does something similar, seeking advice from mentors like Sheryl Sandberg and Warren Buffett. Brian told our class at Stanford, if you find the right source, you don't have to read everything. I've had to learn to seek out the experts. I wanted to learn about safety, so I went to George Tenet, the ex-head of the CIA. Even if you can't meet the best, you can read about the best. Brian lives this advice. He got many of his ideas by assiduously poring over biographies of great entrepreneurs like Walt Disney. Another helpful approach to seeking mentorship is to get help from experts who might be less famous than the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world, but who have faced and solved similar issues in the recent past. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, Dropbox's Drew Houston described how he tries to learn from fellow entrepreneurs who are on the same journey. Talk with other entrepreneurs. Not just famous entrepreneurs, but people who are 1 year ahead, 2 years ahead, 5 years ahead. You learn very different and important things from those kinds of people. It really helps to have a sense of the longer-term arc because the game changes quietly from phase to phase. In addition to seeking help on an ad hoc basis, I believe it's a good idea to be systematic about learning from others. I advise entrepreneurs to have a personal board of advisors or board of directors who can proffer advice and help you fill in the gaps in your knowledge. For example, I have a set of informal advisors who help me learn about the areas that matter to me, including very specific topics like virality or people management. If you're serious about someday blitzscaling a company, you should think of your mentors as a board of directors. Regularly report to them on your progress and ask them how you can do better. Everyone needs feedback. Brian Chesky, for example, likes to say, I'm shameless about getting feedback. He and I have a scheduled dinner every month where, among other things, we share what we've learned and provide feedback. Leveraging a board like this can help you manage risks and increase the potential upside of your actions. This may sound like a lot of work, but it's important to leave yourself time and space for reflection and feedback. It's easy to get caught up in an endless to-do list and to lose sight of what is important. That's one of the things I learned from Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. Mark and Sheryl meet first thing every Monday and at the end of every Friday, no matter how busy they are or what else has come up. The Friday meeting is especially important because it gives them time to look back over the week and reflect on what they've learned. You might feel like you can't afford to take time out from your busy schedule to make yourself better. After all, you might think, everyone is counting on me. This feeling, while natural, is counterproductive. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings warned our Stanford class, when I was running Pure Software, I felt like investing in me was selfish. I thought, I should be working. I was invited to join YPO, Young President's Organization, but I thought, I can't take a day off. I was too busy chopping wood to sharpen the axe. I should have spent more time with other entrepreneurs. I should have done yoga or meditation. I didn't understand that by making myself better, I was helping the company, even if I was away from work. Plus, when you model the behavior of taking the time to improve yourself, you help encourage the rest of the company to develop a culture of learning. 9 counterintuitive rules of blitzscaling. Blitzscaling a company isn't easy. If it were, everyone would do it. Like most things of value in this world, blitzscaling is contrarian. To succeed, you'll have to violate many of the management rules that are designed for efficiency and risk minimization. In fact, To achieve your aggressive growth goals in the face of uncertainty and change, you need to follow a new set of rules that fly in the face of what is taught in business schools and are completely counterintuitive to accepted best practices of either early-stage startups or classic corporate management. Rule number one, embrace chaos. Annual plans, revenue guidance, traditional business structure.